We are ready for argument in our first case, Clatterbuck v. City of Charlottesville. Mr. Fogle.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, as you know, I represent the plaintiff appellants in this case. There can be little doubt that the act of begging, like the act of charitable solicitation, is protected by the First Amendment, and the district court so found. There's no doubt that the pedestrian downtown mall in Charlottesville, comprising eight blocks of the city, is a traditional public forum. The district court so found, and the defendant concedes as much, at least for the purpose of its motion to dismiss. The provision of the city ordinance that's at issue here abridges free speech in a public forum by prohibiting certain speech in a 200-foot area of the mall. For the city to prevail in such an action on its 12B6 motion, or in any other way, it bears the burden of justifying this restriction on free speech. As the Supreme Court has said, when the government defends a regulation of speech as a means to redress past harms or to prevent anticipated harms, it must do more than simply posit the existence of the disease sought to be cured. It must demonstrate that the cited harms are real, not conjectural, and that the regulation will in fact alleviate them to a material degree.
The city makes a little hoarse, so if you can't hear me, let me know.
I'm trying.
The city makes a standing rebuttal to your argument, which, as I understand it, is that once the provisions of the ordinance that relate to restaurants and food cart vendors are out of the case, I understand that to be the case, there isn't a whole lot in your complaint that goes to these zones on behalf of the public streets. Why don't you respond to that? Because obviously if you don't have standing, we don't go any farther.
Well, the complaint alleges, paragraph 11, that the plaintiffs regularly beg on the downtown mall. As I have said, the downtown mall is a limited area of one street in the city of Charlottesville. Paragraph 15, it's alleged that the conduct the plaintiffs have engaged in, to wit begging, and seek to continue, is expressive activity protected by the First Amendment. And finally, in paragraphs 20 and 28, plaintiffs allege that they have suffered damage to their right to communicate to the general public. It is true that we did not allege specifically that my clients had begged, within that specific 50 feet. But as I said in my brief, I think that the defendant's position would be, if we had alleged that we had begged within 20 feet, they would claim that we didn't have standing as to the other 30 feet. But what we have here is a group of citizens who are begging regularly on the downtown mall, who are impecunious, who rely on that begging to sustain themselves.
So would I be correct to conclude that your position is, as far as the pleading aspect that relates to standing, that so long as you have pled that you beg on the mall anywhere, that that's sufficient?
Well, that we regularly beg on the mall as a means to sustain ourselves.
That you regularly beg on the mall somewhere, that's all you had to say to get past a motion to dismiss on standing.
At this juncture, yes. And the district court so found as well. And the question really, I think there's no disagreement about the standard to apply, and the principal standard, as I understand it, for standing is whether or not the party who brings the case before the court has actually been harmed by the provision that they're complaining about, so that helps sharpen the focus of the issue and assures the court that they're not being sought an advisory opinion, that the people who are bringing the action have a real and concrete interest in the outcome of this action. My clients have such a real and concrete interest in the outcome of this interest as it affects their ability on this limited area of one street to continue begging, which, as is alleged, they are required to do as a means to sustain themselves. So it's the factual allegations and, at this juncture, certainly on a 12B6 motion, the reasonable inferences which have to be drawn in the plaintiff's favor, which I believe suffice to establish standing.
You would acknowledge, I would imagine, that the city does have a legitimate interest in traffic safety and security.
No question about it.
I'm assuming that your response would be that it's premature to consider that on 12B6. I mean, how would you envision that city would do what it justifiably could to address that concern.
Well, merely positing that the city has an interest in pedestrian and vehicular traffic doesn't address why they adopted this particular regulation, and it certainly doesn't address the question, which we think is the principal question, that will be the principal question in this case if it's allowed to continue, as to whether or not the city's interest, whether the city's regulation has been narrowly tailored to serve that interest. Mm-hmm. And without knowing precisely what that interest is, it's hard to see whether or not it's narrowly tailored. Now, it's certainly true that a variety of municipalities throughout the country have adopted ordinances which may, for example, prohibit solicitation from the occupants of vehicles, concern about vehicles stopping and thereby creating a potential traffic problem. But I haven't seen any case, and I don't think there is one, or the defendants would have cited it, that would have prohibited solicitation from pedestrians as far as 50 feet away from that intersection under circumstances where the vehicles would not even see the little sign that people carry asking for money. Mm-hmm. So that's my response. Unless we know precisely what the city's trying to deal with, it's hard to determine whether or not it's narrowly tailored. It's impossible to determine. That's a very fact-specific question. And of course, there's very little in the record to establish that narrow tailoring.
Well, it is narrowly tailored, as I understand it, in the sense that it's limited to that 50-foot buffer and when there is vehicular traffic.
Yeah. And that's the essence of what the city has argued is the narrow tailoring. But the question remains, if we have a 50-foot zone and the vehicles are traveling over there and my back is to the vehicles and I'm seeking to solicit from pedestrians and the vehicles can't see anything, how is the city's interest in protecting that implicated? And I say it is not. And in most of the kinds of solicitation that could occur of pedestrians in that zone would not be even seen by the vehicles passing by. And that's why we've argued that even if you had gotten to the point of establishing their interest and so on, which we say they haven't, that it's not narrowly tailored to target the evil that it seeks to redress.
Does the record reflect how large the mall area in question is vis-a-vis the 50-foot buffer?
No. But we, as I said, we're on a motion to dismiss.
Right.
We have virtually nothing. And of course, our complaint was that the district court did not rely on the four corners of the complaint to determine whether or not the plaintiffs had a plausible cause of action, but looked at certain factual information contained that were presented through the city council. In one instance, by a private party as to what he thought should be done, and which was completely conjecture. And in another instance, that was what the district court relied on. The defendants also urged this court to look beyond that and to listen. I don't know whether you took up the defendant's suggestion to listen to the entire or watch the entire video of the city council proceedings, but they urge you to consider the statements made by a city staffer that relate to police reports of some problems that have occurred with pedestrians. Now, we don't...
Would the district judge be permitted, it's not reflected in the opinion, be permitted to take judicial notice of the confines of the downtown mall and of those particular streets if perchance the district judge happened to walk the mall on a regular basis for years? Just curious.
Well, I think there's probably a more adequate basis upon which to take judicial notice. There probably is some maps of the city that would give you precisely what those dimensions were. And I suspect it wouldn't have been contested by us in any event. So I think that the general rule here is that rather the exception to the rule that you cannot consider matters outside the pleading would be judicial notice or where the matter is not contested. So I think there would be circumstances. I don't think virtually just by walking the mall, the district court could have determined the precise parameters of the mall and the distances, but I suspect that there's probably a map in the city that would have been an authoritative description of the breadth and length of the downtown mall that he could have taken judicial notice of, but didn't. Rather relied on what we believe is way outside the record and not permissible under any of the cases of this court or of the Supreme Court. The latest expression by this court talked about matters of which the court could take judicial notice. You can't take judicial, any more than if somebody had testified before the city council and said there's not a problem at that intersection. And in fact, this is only being passed because it's an effort to restrict beggars on the mall, and that it was being enforced in a discriminatory way. Could I prove my case that way? Of course not. I would have to be, whoever said that, you'd have an opportunity to challenge that information, but we were foreclosed from challenging any of the information here by the manner in which the district court decided this case. And as I've argued in my brief, we believe that had the district court decided that it wanted to consider those matters, it should have converted it to a summary judgment motion, given us notice and given us an opportunity to file, I think it's a 56F affidavit, asserting what discovery we might need, and also to put in our own evidence to rebut any of the evidence that was presented by the city. And that was cut short, and we were denied that opportunity. And to conclude this portion, I think that a dangerous precedent is set here, particularly when a governmental entity restricts free speech under circumstances where it has the burden, that it could set up a situation where they simply have shills before the city council to make statements that had no basis in fact.
I didn't hear they have what?
They could have shills.
Oh.
Not sure the dictionary definition.
Oh, I know what a shill is.
Someone to speak on their behalf. and thereby insulate themselves from having to do anything. Simply come in and say, look, it's all in the record of the city council. That's good work. We believe it, and that's all that has to be done. And that's the essence of our position. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You have some time on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Milnor?
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Richard Milnor. I'm from Uncle Milnor Carter in Charlottesville, Virginia. Appreciate the opportunity to be here before you all today. I'm going to start my argument where we start with jurisdiction, standing. The city simply submits that alleging in the complaint that the place where the plaintiffs regularly solicit on the downtown mall is within view of restaurants and cafes, which is regulated by subsection A5, which they did challenge and have withdrawn their challenge to. But that's the place they pled. They didn't plead that they regularly begged on the downtown mall in general. They pled that they did beg on the East Main Street, the downtown pedestrian mall. But where they regularly begged was these cafes. That's their spot. And
there's nothing in the record that reflects the size of the downtown mall. So if we put aside judicial notice for those who may have, perchance over the years, walked the mall, how do we know that this 50-foot buffer zone doesn't comprise the vast majority of the mall?
Well, in this case, of course, and I think what the court is getting to, is, as the court may know, the U.S. District Court in Charlottesville is located at the top of the hill there. It's at just past the far end of the, well, it's at the end of the downtown mall. And Judge Moon heard this case and heard the case in Charlottesville, and it's not a stretch to assume that at lunchtime he casually strolls the mall. And
how would that help us in terms of looking at the record?
I submit that when we're...
More importantly, how does that help you, your client?
I think that the court is permitted to take notice when it's deciding a 12B6 motion of its common experience, what's there, what it knows is there.
And we reviewed
and it was
that
not
how?
Disputed.
Well, it's clearly disputed.
Well,
because appellants are arguing that they have standing.
Well, I submit that the district court can consider its knowledge of the mall. And
how do we, if the district court doesn't say that it did that, how can we take that into account if we don't have that from the, I mean, we may all feel like it would be a pretty good bet to say that Judge Moon did that, but it's not in the record anywhere.
Well, the only place, in one place, and in answer to Judge Davis's question, how does that help you, I was looking for a place, and the place is in Judge Moon's opinion, where he describes alternative avenues of opportunities of communication. And he says, as a casual stroller, as any casual stroller to the mall can see. And I submit that is part of the record, and in his opinion, that he considered as a casual stroller with the what you could see.
Didn't the plaintiffs allege that they anticipated begging in the buffer zone in the future?
No. Judge Moon, in his opinion, recited that they'd adequately pled that they had begged there and wanted to beg, I think, in the future. But there's no citation to any page in Judge Moon's opinion to that spot in the complaint, because I submit that it doesn't exist. The only place, and this is really where the city is on this, that they pled that they regularly beg is their spot as a beggar. The spot that they try and solicit funds is at the cafes and restaurants. And there is no claim or no allegation in the complaint that they have ever begged in the 50-foot areas around these two vehicular crossovers, only when they're open to traffic. And there is no allegation that they ever want to in the future. There's no allegation. I cited Stiefel v. Thompson, I believe, and the Supreme Court talked about whether you have to be prosecuted before you can. You don't have to wait to that to bring a challenge. They're right on that. But that was limited to those circumstances. And in Stiefel, it was obvious that Stiefel was chilled. And we submit that there's no allegation of any chilling here, that, gee, I would like to not regularly just beg in front of these by the restaurants and cafes, but I want to go into this zone. And that is exactly what we're saying, that's no personal stake. It's similar, submit, to what Ms. Stevens did in the Stevens versus County of Albemarle case, where...
Mr. Milner, I have a question on the merits when you finish your response on that.
I'll just be brief. In Stevens, which I was involved in, she pled in her complaint that she was a potential recipient of speech. And while initially Judge Moon had dismissed the case on standing, he reconsidered it, prevailed on the merits on summary judgment. It came up to this court, and this court looked at it again and said, well, where's the standing? But by that time, we'd gone through summary judgment. And at that point, it had been determined that, in fact, Ms. Stevens was not a potential recipient of speech, because she'd never spoken to the booth, she'd never looked at the website, she had no intention of doing so.
That sort of proves the appellant's point in some sense, in that this is not a case that's here on summary judgment.
No.
I mean, if we were, it would be a completely different tack, but we're here on the motion to dismiss, which seems to be the prime argument that they present.
The point I made about was making about Stevens is that they survived on a motion to dismiss in the end, because they did plead that they were the potential recipient of speech. She was, versus in the Bishop versus Bartlett case from this court, which was a motion to dismiss case, and it was dismissed on standing. It wasn't raised by the parties. I believe the court raised it, and in that case, the person had not pled what they needed to plead to show that they were affected by this.
Mr. Milner, I have two questions on the merits. Do you want me to save those for your rebuttal time?
No.
Or you can start.
I'll start.
First of all, I have a concern about the district court's finding that the speech was content neutral based on the identity of the speaker and that all speakers were treated similarly, which really isn't the test. So do you want to start with that one?
On content neutrality, the district court did, I think as the court notes, feel that, and as is evident on the face of the ordinance, that it doesn't distinguish between solicitors by either their identity. They could be the Boy Scouts.
That's correct. But that's not really relevant, is it? I mean, the question is whether it involves, whether it requires a consideration of the content of the speech, and that is exactly what it relies on. The content of the speech has to be examined to determine whether the request is for an immediate donation of something of value. You're not going to know unless you know what the content of the speech is. So regardless of whether it turns on the identity of the speaker, it certainly turns exclusively on the content of the request.
Well, I'd submit that it's not like where you have newspaper racks and you can't have some kind of newspaper or commercial newspapers, but you can't have the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. It's not that. It's not, and the Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, it are not. It's not that. And what the court's asking is, don't we have to look at the content of what is an immediate? Is this sign? Is this outstretched hand? Is this hat a request for an immediate donation of money?
And I, how can you do that without knowing what the speech is? Because someone could be doffing his hat or extending his hand to be shaken. You have to don't you have to look at the content of the speech, and is that not inconsistent with the determination of content neutrality?
I submit that it's not. I submit that in guidance I could get on that issue was in Justice Kennedy's concurring opinion that was actually cited by plaintiffs in the International Society of Krishna Consciousness versus Lee, where Justice Kennedy looked at...
Mr. Milner, I appreciate the precedent, but look, if you could just sort of focus on the facts here. How would a police officer approaching someone know whether he or she was making, in the words of the ordinance, a request for an immediate donation of or something of value? How would that determination have to be made?
I think it would have to be made by his observations of, by seeing, hearing what he sees and
hears,
and what the person who potentially is being solicited has said. He could see,
which is a way of examining the content of the speech, right?
Oh, I think it would be, and this may be splitting hairs, but it goes...
Are you familiar with our recent case called Wagmore Dogs?
I've read that.
You think that might be relevant to your answer here? You can think about that if you want. Tell us on rebuttal.
Thank you. May I reserve my...
Of course.
Well, you've got to... If I may, what other speech is regulated by this ordinance? What other speech?
You mean the other places?
No. What other speech?
It's the request for immediate donations of money or things of value.
That's what's regulated. My question is, what else is regulated?
Well, by the ordinance also regulates aggressive panhandling, but the...
Which is not challenged.
It's not challenged.
Right.
But the only thing that is challenged is the request for immediate donations of money in this.
And that's the only thing that the ordinance proscribes. Correct?
That's what it says.
Okay.
But
if you can respond briefly to Judge Davis's question, please go ahead.
I submit that it also is focusing on the request for the immediate donation of money in and of itself is a narrowing definition of solicit, and it takes it beyond just it takes it to a level where it's actually in a way conduct that is being attempted to be regulated by causing people to request for immediate donations of money, causing people to flee from a solicitor, or causing a car to be causing a vehicle operator to be distracted and potentially causing an accident. So I think it's speech, but it's also something more.
Thank you.
Just to continue in that vein, the ordinance does not prescribe any other speech in that location, including speech that would clearly be as distractive to drivers as a simple sign or a hand or a hat. The speech could be in the form of beautiful signs, and in fact, this is not in the record, but the city has beautiful signs right at the intersection when we have the Festival of the Photograph and the Festival of the Film, and I assure you they're much more attractive than the signs that my clients are holding, and would be more likely to distract drivers than the signs my clients were holding.
I was curious about the parameters of the ordinance and phrasing it that the prescribed behavior is an immediate donation of money or other thing of value. What's the other? I mean, would a request for a vote, a signature on a petition now, or a signature on a petition tomorrow? What does that other thing of value cover?
It's a very good question, and I don't think there's an answer to it because there is no definition in the ordinance of what that other thing of value would be. Certainly to a politician, a signature on a petition in order to be on the ballot would be a thing of great value, maybe the most important thing of value to that politician.
Just the politician, but right. Anyone advocating for
cause.
Ballot initiative or referendum or...
And perhaps somebody soliciting directions from somebody who was driving down the downtown mall because they assumed that they knew the area would also be of importance to the person soliciting the direction. And would that be a thing of value? It would seem that it might be. But the important point to us is that it would be equally distracting as would the claimed signs that my clients were holding. But again,
it would be equally necessary to look at the message
right.
To determine.
Right.
I guess that's the point. Yeah.
We think we can go beyond that in establishing that it was not content neutral. And we've also alleged that the city adopted this ordinance specifically to restrict the rights of beggars and not to restrict the rights of others. I wanted to address Judge Agee briefly on Wagmore Dogs, whether it was relevant here. And I know it was cited by the defendants.
You're addressing the panel.
Pardon me?
So you're not addressing me, you're addressing the panel.
I agree. I wanted to respond to the question, rather, that you raised and address that to the panel. This is a different case. That case was dismissed on a 12B6 motion, but under very different circumstances. First off, that was a commercial free speech case. This is a political free speech case. Second, the purpose of the ordinance in that case and the problem that it sought to address were stated right in the ordinance itself. So there was no question as to what the city was seeking to accomplish by that ordinance. And finally, there was, and most importantly to us, is there was no issue of narrow tailoring that was addressed in that case. And to quote the court there in footnote 3, they said, consistent with, there were 30 years of case law, both from this circuit and from the Supreme Court, looking at sign ordinances and finding that they pass constitutional muster. and that under those limited circumstances, there was no need for, as the court said, voluminous evidence justifying a regulation of the type that has been upheld several times over. We don't have anything like that either in this court or in the Supreme Court.
Help me with the distinction, the significance of the distinction between commercial free speech and political free speech.
As a factual matter or as to the law?
Well, you were positing it as a significant difference between the facts of this case and the facts of Wagmore Dogs, and if you could elaborate on that.
Simply that we afford more protection for political speech than we do to commercial speech, and that the holding of the Supreme Court in Schamburg, which held that charitable solicitations were speech, rejected the notion that it was commercial speech. It is political speech in the eyes of the Supreme Court, and that's what we rely on.
So are you saying that your clients are engaged in political speech?
Just as the Salvation Army is engaged in political speech right now in the downtown mall, ringing their bell, seeking contributions for the poor.
Well, isn't that inconsistent with your complaint? I thought you pled that this was how they made their living.
I'm sorry. Yes.
I thought this is how they made their living. How is that political speech instead of commercial speech?
Because as the Supreme Court described in Schomburg, the kind of speech that seeks solicitations and donations for the poor has a variety of political messages that are contained within it. And it is the same principle that is applied here. The purpose of putting that in the complaint...
You pled they were soliciting for the poor, as I recall your complaint. You pled this is how we make our living.
Yes. And the reason that's in the complaint is to demonstrate why there is a concrete cause of action here, why it is that my clients will continue to beg on the downtown mall, and why this restriction is going to impede that for the future. And that's why it's there. But this has never been construed by any circuit court in the country, and I dare doubt by any district court, that begging constitutes commercial speech. It has always been considered consistent with the Supreme Court's view of general charitable solicitation, that that's not commercial, that's political speech. Just a couple of other points. My adversary makes a big point of saying that we allege that we regularly beg in front of restaurants and cafes on the downtown mall, and that's the only place that we've alleged that we beg. Well, the record is devoid of the fact that perhaps all of those restaurants are in that buffer zone. We don't know that. So that's another area where the record is devoid, and where a further factual development would be necessary, and why we seek to vacate the district court's order. One final point, which is that if the court does end up determining, as I've said, that there is no standing here, we think that the proper remedy would not be to uphold the district court's dismissal, but would be to remand with the opportunity to amend in order to add that little sentence in there. And frankly, were I doing it again, I would have put it in there to avoid this very argument. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Milner.
The city submits that with respect to the standing argument, that what this comes down to is whether a allegation in the complaint that they regularly solicit in the area of the downtown mall no longer subject to challenge is sufficient to give them standing in an area regulated by the section that they challenge. And where they don't allege that they've ever begged in that area, want to beg, or have been chilled from begging there. Now,
would it be a reasonable inference, entirely consistent with Rule 12b-6 jurisprudence, that a person who seeks a donation outside the 50-foot buffer zone might well follow his or her target into the 50-foot buffer zone? I'm just trying to explore, as best I can, your standing argument, because I confess I'm having real difficulty with it. Because your argument, as I understand it, is that there's no injury in fact, right? That's the one criterion.
No injury in fact.
No injury in fact.
And no, not
so. How can there not be injury in fact if a person is prohibited assuming there is some area of the mall, we don't know that because we don't have a record, but assuming there is some area of the mall at which someone could seek a donation, my question is, could that person follow his or her target into the 50-foot buffer zone where it is prohibited, and would that not be injury in fact? Maybe my question is not clear.
No, I don't think under our analysis of standing it would not be sufficient, because the pleading in this case, the allegation in the complaint is that they beg in the downtown mall on East Main Street.
And you say the district court correctly refused to draw the inference that that allegation covered the buffer zone, right?
Yes.
My question is, if we give you that, what about the inference that someone might follow a targeted donor into the buffer zone?
I still submit that under Bishop Bartlett, that they would have to make, if they had simply made the allegation.
But I'm taking it beyond the black letter allegation and asking you about the permissibility of inferences in favor of the plaintiff's standing. Because if I understand you correctly, you're saying they have no interest in soliciting in the buffer zone.
No personal stake in soliciting in the buffer zone because in this particular case, they
because of the allegations. My question, and this is the last time I'm going to ask it, I promise, is there not a reasonable basis for inferring that they would follow someone into the buffer zone, right? Some guy who reaches into his pocket 2 feet outside the buffer zone in response to a solicitation, who keeps walking. Would not it be reasonable to infer that one of the plaintiffs would follow that person, cross the threshold of 50 feet into the buffer zone in order to receive whatever the thing of value he believes is coming out of the pocket of the donor or the potential donor? I guess I've sketched it out much too.
He would be violating the law.
Yeah.
Yes, he would.
And therefore he'd have standing.
No.
Right?
But
he could get arrested as soon as he crossed that 50-foot marker, right?
He could.
Okay. If it appeared to someone that the content of his speech reflected that he was making an immediate request for something like that.
If it was just an address of the soup kitchen, local soup kitchen, that was coming out of the pocket, then it wouldn't be a thing of value, and therefore it wouldn't be a violation, presumably. Or maybe that's valuable enough.
Well, it is focused on, and I do think that that's critical. On the definition of solicit is for immediate donations of money, which...
Or other thing of value.
Or other things of value. But it's the immediate, it's the request for that, the immediate request for that, that concerned Justice Kennedy in the Krishna case. And I submit that it's what takes in terms of content neutrality. It almost separates, it would be one thing if it was solicit, but this is solicit with no definition. This is limited to request for immediate donation of money. And
by the way, I'm sorry, you didn't even title, of course we don't have the motions here in the record, but you didn't even title your motion as an alternative motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim, or in the alternative for summary judgment, right? You didn't
No.
do that. And you certainly didn't ask the district court to convert the motion into a motion for summary judgment.
No.
As allowed by rule.
And of course, if I'd not survived. We prevailed. No, we did not. Okay. And
but you did attach a request that the court look at that video. I mean, the court didn't go get that on its own, right?
Correct.
It obtained that information at your specific request.
The argument was in the brief that, and all these things that I'm saying are reflected in the basic, assuming legislative record, this is when it was enacted.
Okay.
And here's where you can go look at it.
Okay.
And then when we argued in the brief, I expanded on it.
Right.
And as to that point, Judge Boone in his footnote on page 11, footnote 7, I believe, refers to the fact that he finds that this regulation is constitutional on its face as a reasonable time, place, and manner restriction, and which is narrowly tailored, the 50 feet.
That's kind of the problem. And he made findings. There's no question he made findings
on the base
on a Rule 12b6 motion.
Yes.
I mean, he talks about how some of the vendors may have paid a licensing fee to the city, and there's a lot in that footnote.
There is a lot in the footnote, but in the footnote he says it supports his reason, and so I'm saying that if the court rules you can't consider those sources that are central to the claim, still Judge Moon's opinion should be upheld. And on the content neutrality, I think Wagmore Dogs reaffirmed the test in Hill versus Colorado, but I see my time is up.
Thank you very much, Mr. Milner. We will come down and greet counsel and then proceed directly to the next case.